Hi, you're listening to SupDoc.
It's a show where we talk to interesting people about documentary films that they have strong opinions about. I'm George Chen.
And I'm Paco Romain. And today we talk about the documentaries The Source Family and The Arrival with filmmaker Jody Willey.
And this is a different kind of talk because Jody actually made The Source Family. She's an archivist and researcher on utopian groups, and she's up from Los Angeles at the SF International Film Festival where we caught up with her.
Yeah, so I checked out Source Family. I mean, I saw it, I'd say maybe 6 or 7 months ago.
Oh, yeah.
And then I watched it again just a few days ago in preparation. Cool. Just incredible. Like, so did they just document everything?
They documented a lot. And really, the documentation happened, it really kind of got supercharged when ISIS came to town. You know, when ISIS was Charlene Peters and... Mm-hmm. And she joined the family, and she had been she'd been engaged to marry Ron Raffelli, who was like Jimi Hendrix's primary photographer, and had a really good life going. I mean, she was like hanging out with the Stones and Karen Carpenter and all those people.
Stones and Karen Carpenter.
Yes, like quite a variety. And, you know, so she had this very privileged life, but when she saw Jim Baker at the Source restaurant, there was this just like crazy feeling. She says she felt like her whole body changed, and she was just like, oh my God, this is like it. This is the most interesting thing I've ever seen. It's amazing. I'm leaving everything behind. And she brought cameras in from the studio, and they just started taking a lot of pictures. And that was the first night in the family that she was there. She recorded the first birth in the family that you saw in the film.
Was like the first
I didn't see it because
I did this. I held my hand up.
That's where I love watching the audience, because men become children in that shot, that scene. They just start whimpering and crying when they watch that.
It went a direction I did not expect it to go. I'm just like, this is very sad. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, maybe he's a miracle worker. Because he just, I'm assuming that the audience has seen this movie at this point, because it's been out for a while. But yeah, like he revives his stillborn child.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing that she documents. I didn't put that together, that because her fiance was Ron Raffelli, that she was a photographer also, or she had access to the photo equipment.
Yeah, I mean, she was really managing the studio when she was with Ron, but then she kind of came into her own, because there was actually Ron's assistant was in the Source family, and that was how she got to go visit the Source. It was one day when Ron had to find some Jesuses for a Jesus Christ Superstar campaign he was doing, and she was like, I'll go to the Source, of course. And then, so there was one photographer, but ultimately about five people in the family took all the pictures, and some of them were really good. I mean, those photos are amazing.
Yeah.
Good cameras.
Was the woman at the end who says that she had to film the funeral and stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, that's still ISIS, right?
That's ISIS, right?
Yeah, okay.
That's ISIS. Yeah.
What name do you think I would have been given if I'd been in the Source family?
Oh, gosh. Let me
Can
tune
you just,
into
yeah,
you.
Yeah, just look into my eyes. Just think about it for a second.
Yeah. I don't know why I want to say Sunstar.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. I think Sunstar Aquarius.
Sunstar.
What about George? What do you think he would have?
Raphael.
Okay. A Ninja Turtle. A Ninja Turtle Source Family.
It's because of
you're
eating.
You're my Splinter. Yeah, Father Splinter.
Listen, Archangel, Ninja Turtle, Sculptor. He was a Mega Man.
Yeah.
Raphael.
I think it's because you're eating pizza.
Yes, mostly. I have a calzone in my hand right now. There are so many questions about just Jim Baker before we even get to the Yod period. Is it Yod or Yod?
Yod. Yes.
Because I also first heard of Father Yod through Byron Coley.
I know. Byron thought he was Yod because he didn't know anybody in the family.
Right.
But so Byron was like the fearless pioneer. You know, nobody knew anything when he jumped in.
Yeah, like because he had the name. So Byron Coley is a music journalist who had a label called Father Yod. And he's out of Boston. He's just like an early punk guy. And like that's the first thing I ever heard about it. And then he did a label with Thurston Moore called Ecstatic Yod.
Right.
So that's the first thing I'd ever heard about. I'm like, what is that related to? People are like, oh, it's this cult thing. You gotta check it out. And I guess the recordings is probably what got him into it, right?
Yeah, back in the late 80s, there was like this sort of East Coast group of rabid collectors, you know, of esoteric stuff that came across the Source Family records. And it was a big source of mystery because nobody knew anything about the family, but they really dug the music. They thought it was very interesting, and they love the album art. It's like, you know, some of the best album art of all time, yeah. Right? Yeah. And but nobody knew anything. And so for me, like in 1999, I had a friend who turned me onto the box set that Captain Trip put out, the Japanese psych label. It's like a box set of all the Yehoah 13 records. It's kind of deluxe, fancy. My friend was just like, Jody, have you ever seen this? And I looked at it, and it was just this picture of Father Yod in black and white with his devotees kind of in his belly. And it said, Yehoah, God and hair. Nice. And I was just like, what? What is this? And he was like, oh, what is this cult that was in LA in the 70s? And I was like, what? How could that have? Because I have like studied, researched all of these different cults for like 20 years. I thought I was like an aficionado, and I was like, how did I not know about the Source family, especially if they were making music and right. they were gorgeous? Like, where, why have I not been told the story? And that was what started me kind of digging.
Yeah. Well, so why do you think it was that you'd kind of missed them?
Everybody did. Yeah.
Yeah. And can you speak to like how for the last 20 years have you been sort of, what got you onto this path of like researching these groups?
I think it's because I came from a very loving Christian family, but like kind of a strict one, you know, and I grew up in a very safe, sheltered suburban environment. And so I was always just drawn to like the weirdest stuff possible and wanted to just explore like the most radical, craziest fringes. I don't know. I was like a magnet to that for some reason. My poor parents, you know, tried to protect me. But yeah, so I just I think part of it is growing up like in a Christian environment where it was like not a hypocritical environment, because my parents are very loving people and the church was like a moderate church. So I understand spirituality. It doesn't freak me out. I don't think Christians are all like evangelical nutcases, you know?
Right.
But at the same time, there was always something about it that wasn't quite enough for me. And what's really interesting to me is getting to explore. I'm very interested in radical spiritual communities and subcultures, you know, because there's something there. Like, these people are able to build meaningful lives and meaningful cosmologies out of the sort of wildest stuff. It's so wild to like mainstream culture. It's wild to intellectual culture. And it's almost taboo, and I like exploring taboos. To me, it's sort of one of the last taboos, which is this kind of spirituality that most people can't fit in their brains, you
like
know?
Extreme charismatic spirituality, or just structures that are like, non-traditional structures.
Sort of like it's like a radical spirituality, meaning people who demand like a direct ecstatic experience. Like, they want to take the acid. They want to go to those places. They don't want to be told what it's about from a messenger. They want to like get there themselves, and they often have like a charismatic leader, but that leader's not like a saint. He's more like an initiate. Like, I'm going to show you some stuff. Come on in. Let me show you. I'm going to initiate you to this other realm of seeing, you know. And so Father Yod for sure did that. I mean, he was much more of like what scholars would call a magus, you know? So a magus is kind of like a trickster. Right. He's like somebody who's got access to other realms that you don't have. He's extraordinary in other ways. He can produce phenomena. Uriel did this too. Uriel from Unarius, that other group. Mm-hmm. But they're not supposed to be, your messiah. They're not supposed to be a saint, you know, that there's something else, you know.
But don't, it seems like the majority of times they kind of get to that point.
Yeah, right? Because you know why? Because I think we live in a Judeo-Christian culture exactly. Where we like demand a messiah.
Yeah.
We don't want to do any of the work ourselves, God's sakes.
No, please. Just bring the pedestal now. Put that person up there so we can get to.
Let me just say I believe in you so all those horrible things I did last night can just go away.
So you said you grew up in suburbia. Where is that at?
Yeah, that was in Ohio.
Oh.
Yeah.
The great state of Ohio, the Buckeye State.
It was, yeah. What about you guys?
I grew up in Michigan.
Oh, you're kidding. Yeah. Which part of Michigan?
It's beautiful southwest Michigan area near Kalamazoo.
Oh, okay.
Michigan, yeah.
Yeah.
West side Michigan, what? Throw a gang.
That's a good thing for podcasts, throw that gang sign.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Can't see my WM.
It looked legit.
Yeah, it was pretty
legit.
I'm
from San Jose, so I've been in the Bay Area for the last Well, pretty much my whole life, but yeah, 20 years up in the East Bay. So, yeah.
I also grew up in a crazy religious Christian fundamentalist. The word of God was directly brought through the Bible to us.
Really?
We couldn't say the word geez because it was half of Jesus.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, and we're talking Jesus Camp, that documentary.
Oh, I love that documentary. Yeah. So good.
We're going to do an interview next week about Jesus Camp. Have you ever seen Marjo?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Love Marjo. I like any weird Christian stuff,
me
you know?
Me too. I love Marjo Gortner. Like that whole, well, we can talk about that at some other time, but I love that documentary.
Oh, yeah.
That's actually, I credit that documentary with being the documentary that got me into documentaries.
Interesting. I could see that, though, especially coming from your background.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When he's throwing the money up in the hotel room, they're smoking joints, and he's just like, look how much money I made talking about Christianity with these people. And he's telling his crew, he's like, wear ties, don't look like hippies, because you're going to scare them. This is how we get money. Then he's talking to that other pastor, and they're splitting up the money. Oh, my God. It was
so good. So good.
Amazing.
America's so much more interesting than most people give it credit for.
Just lift it.
They're too busy, like, obsessing over the Kardashians.
Yes. Screw the Kardashians.
Screw
They're not fucking interesting at all. Lift the little veneer off America's like top and you will find a lot of interest.
The Kardashians just got really interesting.
You know what? You're right. And I told that to my nieces and nephews. I remember.
Mother Bruce.
Oh, yeah. My nieces and nephews in Ohio were like talking about the Kardashians one day. And I was like, you kids, there's nothing interesting about the Kardashians except that Bruce Jenner wants to be a woman. And they were like, what? What does that mean?
They didn't even know about that part of it.
Yeah.
Now, actually, so you, your relationship to these guys, the Source Family, because were you involved in the publishing of the book or they had put the book together first?
I was involved in the publishing of the book. In fact, what happened was I saw the box set years ago. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, I went online at the time and there was really nothing there. I think that I maybe only saw the Byron Coley article that later I found out had like kind of wildly inaccurate things because there's nothing before that. You know, he was just doing what he could. But in, you know, like 2004, maybe, my ex-husband, Adam Parfrey, who runs Feral House Books, he was at Amoeba Records, and in the middle of like the CD, classical CD section, he looked, and there was a student film on the Source Family.
A student film?
Yeah. It's worth watching, too. It's really pretty good. There's some good interviews, and he looked at it, and he was like, ooh, I bet Jody would like that. He came home, and I was like, oh, my God! I've been dying to know more about these people. I can't find anything about them. We watched the film. I was so struck by I mean, it's definitely a student film for sure, but there was some archival stuff in there, and I was like, whoa, these films and these stills look great. And then the interviews with the people were so, they were so intelligent and they were so charming. It was not what I expected at the time, because for me, I just had the standard idea of what a cult is at that point, like, which is like,
Heaven's Gate.
Yeah, it's Manson. Like, it's gotta be like these crazy brainwashed lemmings. And I was like, these are people I want to hang out with. These are like really funny, charming. These sound like Hollywood insiders who have like seen some things that most people never get to see. And that led me to find them online. And right when I reached out, they had a website. I noticed at that point, Isis Aquarian wrote me back. I said, I'm a book publisher. Have you guys ever thought about doing a book? She wrote me back. She's like, well, it turns out my quote unquote brother, Electricity, and I have been working on a book for 7 years and we just finished it.
Wow.
And
good old Electricity.
I know Electricity. Yeah. They're all so like amazing. Each person from the Source Family, it's like a bunch of chiefs in the room too. They are not like cult members. Like they all have very strong opinions about everything. Like they're very developed and self-aware. So anyway, that led to me going to Hawaii, and then they had this book that was kind of a self-published thing that we worked to rewrite and expand for a broader audience, and that became The Source, The Untold Story of Yehoah 13, you know, Father Yoda and the Source Family. And then that, after that, I brought on my friend Maria Demopoulos, who's a commercial director, because once Isis showed me the archive, she was like, you know, I thought it was just photos at first, and she was like, well, we have like 5 hours of family home movies and videos we made on public access.
What?
And that's what I said. And as soon as she told me that and I looked at it, I was a music video director like in my early 20s, you know, a long time ago. So I hadn't been in that world for a while. But one of my closest friends, Maria, is this really talented commercial director. I was like, we got to do this. Let's do it. So that was how the documentary came about.
Oh, wow. The editing's really great.
Right. Jen Harrington did a fantastic job with that. She's a filmmaker too. She makes horror movies.
Oh,
actually.
Wow.
Like really smart. She's like an emerging horror filmmaker.
It's very smart editing. Like the way the using the archival footage with the narration and the storytelling and
Thank you.
Was really good. Yeah. It told the story really well. And I was all the time. I was like, how do they have this much? Like from the early 70s, like who was filming this much?
Yeah.
It had to be film, obviously.
You know, a number of people filmed in the family, but Isis really should be credited. She, even now, whenever we go anywhere, she's got her camera out and she's shooting. Like, she's way more of a documentarian than I am.
Uh-huh.
Like a true documentarian. She's always recording stuff. And I think she just had this compulsive personality. She thought what they were doing, they all thought that what they were doing was really important, even though no one else even knew what was going on behind closed doors there. So I just really thank Isis for being this incredible, not just a documentarian, but an archivist, because when the family broke up, they had hard times. And there were times when Isis was like living in a hallway and her only possessions were like these boxes of photo albums and recordings and just like a few other things. Like she really held on when nobody else could or nobody else cared even.
Right. There was one guy who sold his staffing company for $60 million or something.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what a lot of people don't realize, not just with the Source family, but with a lot of these social experiments that happened in the 60s and 70s, these so-called cults, communes, homesteads, is that that period, like 69 to 75, a lot of people, even writers and scholars, think that like the whole counterculture died in 69 with Manson and Altamont. For me, with my independent research and getting to know a lot of people who lived through that period, I feel like 69 is when people really got serious. Like they were like, holy shit, like this, you know, the flower power is not working.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like we cannot work with the man. We're going to have to build our own world. We're going to have to build our own society. And so I feel like these communities attracted some of the brightest lights of the era, you know, these really bright lights that wanted to explore things beyond what they'd been shown, you know. And so if you had a spiritual leader who was actually kind of, I mean, everybody I talked to with about Father Yod was like, he was really like, he was clairvoyant. Like he was producing phenomena I cannot explain. And I've heard from a number of groups back then where somebody was doing that. And what that did was it just allowed people to sort of expand beyond their own mindset and into new possibilities. And what happened was these groups, I think, not just the spiritual ones, but the anarchist communities, the craft communities, they served as cultural incubators where people could get away from the mainstream ideas and brainwash and they could figure out new ideas and new ways of being. And most people don't realize that, you know, Steve Jobs was a fruitarian and lived on a commune. He was like an acid dropping hippie. He was totally part of the scene. Stuart Brand, one of the founders of the internet, I mean, he was one of the publishers of the Whole Earth catalog, which was like the engine for these people. And then in the Source family, we had Magus the Aquarian, who went to sell his internet headhunting staffing company for like $60 million during the dot-com boom. And then Zinaru and the family, who became a stem cell pioneer.
Oh, right.
And then there were others. Those were just a couple I mentioned, but there was one woman who founded two really successful vegetarian restaurants and then started this organization for women in third world countries that worked with United Nations. Like there were people who went on to do really interesting things. And that happened a lot with these groups, the people who sort of laid the groundwork for like the mind, body, spirit trend, the yoga trend, Whole Foods. The CEO of Whole Foods was like a vegetarian living in a cooperative. Like they were doing radical stuff that like hipsters nowadays are only starting to fantasize about. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it seems like there's been a lot of, I don't know what I'm saying. I did have a thought about like the way you guys structured it when there's a progression of where things seem like they're all fun rock and roll times, and then things start to turn dark around sexual stuff or like jealousy or like his and Robin's relationship.
Yeah.
And then when you have the more present day stuff, like you talk to the daughter Tao, uh-huh. and she sort of like doesn't seem to have like doesn't have a relationship with him really, or have really concrete memories of him. Because was Robin sort of, did she leave and then take her daughter? Is that what happened?
By the way, I want to say, besides being social incubators, these were also like high risk experiments. They were,
yes.
they were not, you know, people were not getting in there with the guarantee that it'd be all like fun and safe and there wouldn't be any like collateral damage or anything, you know. It was definitely a very kind of risky, it was like being in a rock band. You know, in a rock band, you get to experience these like highs that nobody else can touch who watches you in the audience necessarily, but then you get the really bad lows, you know, like your singer's a junkie and he's an asshole and kills himself, or you know what I mean? It's like you're playing, it's high stakes.
Yeah.
And internet startups are the same way. You know what I mean? It's like you have the same drama, radical social interactions, you know?
Yeah.
So with the documentary, it was tricky because we only had 90 minutes, mm-hmm. and really, if I could have, I would have made it like a 6-part documentary.
There's so much there.
There's so much, and then there's so much that that really could have colored it in different ways. So what we tried to do was we just got like a, it was really just like a superficial. We were kind of hitting on the main points of the history and getting little tidbits here and there that could allude to deeper things, you know. And what's interesting is we really wanted to make the film like a Rorschach test. Because we knew that some people would see it, mm-hmm. and they would just be like, oh my gosh, this, you know, this is so horrible. He had 13 wives. He was so bad towards Robin. This is awful. And then we knew that there would be people who would see it and just be like, wow, he really, like, kept his integrity in the end when he said, I'm just a man, you know, and I want to join that thing. Man, they were doing some great stuff, you know. That's exactly what's happened. And so, you know, with Robin, it's easy to read it and say, oh, he was exploiting the women.
Right, right.
But if you listen carefully, you hear the other women and they're just like, you know, it was the greatest experience of my life. Yeah. Like, no, yeah. That's what they tell me.
Yeah.
Like I've gotten to know most of the 13 women. And I would say there are only two. Robin, there's one other who was like, well, I feel like he was taking advantage of me, but I learned so much and he's great and I'm okay with it now. Mm-hmm. You know, but Robin was like a junkie. She was a heroin junkie before she came into the Source family. She had a lot of issues before she came in, and issues after, you know, as well. So it's really tricky. Like what we tried to say in the Source family with that last line, you know, when you've got Omni saying, nobody's writing the script for you. You write the script. You can be a victim or a hero. That's kind of what I felt like when I was getting to meet all those people in the Source family. Some of them interpreted it so differently, and all of them came in on their own free will. All of them could have left at any time. Not that it wouldn't have been easy, especially if you're a mom with a kid, a single mom, and your parents have disowned you, like Robin, you know? So she definitely had a hard time, but it's just you can't make easy...
No.
You can't make easy judgments. It's very complex and very nuanced.
What I liked also is that it seemed like you guys took an unbiased approach to showing who the Source family. It wasn't certainly made by ideologues of the Source family.
Yeah.
It had an unbiased, although it did seem like the filmmakers, I get you and your co-director, mm-hmm. and seemed like there was a certain amount of fun involved. Like you guys... kind of, I don't know, it's watching that, and I've just met you now, but I felt like there was a certain amount of like, kind of like, I wish I was part of that, you know? Does that
yeah,
make
that
sense?
Was me. That See, was you. That's I like drank the Kool-Aid, but Maria's got like, you know, a son who's, you know, was 8 years old, and she was just like, oh my God. Like, Maria's one of my oldest friends, but we have totally different views of the Source family, mm-hmm. and I think that allowed it to produce the balance, you know, because
I
knew, and that's what it was. It was like, I would say it was definitely subjective, but balance. We really wanted to show all the sides to it, and to it fairly in a way where it reflected the ratio of who felt what. And in a way, I feel like it kind of fairly did, but in a way, from the people I talked to, like, there were definitely more people than not who were like, oh my God, it was the greatest thing I ever did in my life. All the bad stuff doesn't even matter now. Like, I'm so glad I did it.
Right.
And that's just the reality. It's hard to imagine that for some people, but I can imagine it because I feel like most people go through mundane American consumer culture like robots. You know, it's like they graduate school. They're told what to do in school. They're told what to do in college. They get a job. They're in a cubicle. They're like, this is what's meaningful, and that's it. You know, the Source family, groups like the Source family, they just broke people out of that in a way that you could never be the same afterwards. You can never go back to that cubicle because you know what it's like to be free.
That is true.
You know, and even though you've got this charismatic dude who's, you know, kind of like a big power, like a macho Peter Pan, like telling you what to do, at the same time, he's really telling you, you know, think for yourself. You don't have to live in the suburbs with two kids. You know, you can really make decisions from your heart. You can make your decisions from a deeper place.
You can make decisions from your heart, and you should probably also take hang gliding lessons. I mean, I think like those a couple of lessons from that documentary. So I feel like, should we jump into
that,
the arrival?
Yeah, sure. And that was actual hang gliding footage from, were they filming that hang gliding?
No, actually, you know what? That was different hang gliding footage. The stills, though, were actual, and the audio recording was actual.
Right. Yeah,
so they were there on that day, and Isis recorded everything. She's just amazing. I can't believe she was there to do that.
That's incredible.
I know.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Well, let's jump into and talk about the arrival for a second. So I don't even know where to begin with Unarius, Universal Articulate Interdimensional Understanding of Science.
Nice. Yeah. Yes, that's it.
And after watching the arrival, I don't feel like I had a universal articulate interdimensional understanding of science at all.
Well, maybe not in your intellectual way, but on a deeper level, you probably knew exactly what was going on.
I kind of. I do think I do want Archangel Uriel to be my grandma. That much. Totally. That much I know. I know she wouldn't give out Werther's. She'd have something a little better than Werther's did.
She was really into cake.
She was into cake. Is that what you just said? Yes.
Cake and fruit Cadillacs. Punch. Fruit punch served from multi-tiered electric fountains.
No, get out.
No, I'm serious. I got to go through their newsletters, and after the premiere of their movie, A Visit to the Underground Cities of Mars, she wrote this ecstatic review of what it was like. She was like, you know, in the Unarius, in the Unarius Academy, we showed the premiere of the movie, and she talked about how much everybody loved it, and how after the premiere, cake and fruit punch served in electric multi-tiered fountains was enjoyed by all.
Sign me up.
And then a midnight dinner at their favorite Italian restaurant. Like, it's so sweet.
That is, yeah, there's obviously a very sweet, childlike essence. I almost said aura, but I don't want to say aura. Essence to that. Like, I watched The Arrival, and I did a lot of reading about them. Can you tell the people who will be listening to this about what The Arrival is quickly and how you came about to showing it?
So Unarius was a group that started in 1954 with these two clairvoyants, Ernest and Ruth Norman, who fell in love and decided to make this educational foundation that was dedicated to helping advance mankind through encouraging that everyone is psychic, and that we all, you know, we've all lived before. They were very much into the principles of reincarnation, but also the idea that many of man's problems in this current lifetime, you know, any neurotic tics, you know, relationship problems, physical problems, are a result of past life experiences. And that sounds really far out to a lot of people, but what most people don't realize is that you know, most like traditional cultures across the world believe in reincarnation. Eastern cultures believe in it. Henry Ford believed in it. Mark Twain, General Patton. You know what I mean? Like, we're just in this period in American culture right now where it's not in fashion, but it was really in fashion in the 70s, you know, and so were UFOs, you know, with Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And Ruth Norman, after the passing of her husband, who was really kind of a low key guy about all this, you know, he was like, you know, I want to do this all via mail order, but he was a very powerful channel. She was really exuberant. You know, she liked to get out there and have parties and stuff. And so she saw that they had a lot of these kids. They had a lot of very talented young people who were coming to her classes and like in their early 20s and really into filmmaking. And so she decided to set up a film lab. So she was into past life psychodrama therapy. Which is, okay, so you can heal, the idea is you can heal these issues in your current life by tuning in into who you were in other lifetimes and reenacting those lifetimes, the trauma part. So what you have in the Unarius films, in their film canon, is you have these extraordinary films with no actors, no scripts, but real Unarian students who have tuned into what they believe are their previous lifetimes together. They've made their own costumes. They've got elaborate, like, blue face makeup or whatever, depending on what planet they're on. Right. Elaborate sets. And then they have these really intense emotional interchanges because they really believe that this is who they are. They're just replaying themselves in order to discharge the negative thing. So The Arrival, which many people who love outsider films, film nerds consider like their masterwork, right? Because the special effects are
special
so
effects.
Pretty great.
Over
pretty
great the effects. Oh, they're unbelievable.
They're so Tron-ish.
They're yeah.
I mean, right. I thought I was watching Tron again.
Right.
You know, from when I saw it first. And
but then
go ahead. I was gonna say like the special effects are good, but then like the costuming still has like its weird seams, like all the bald wigs. You can still see the seams. Like, they spent a lot of money on like this part, but then the costumes, right. Like, yeah. Well,
there hasn't been great advancements in eyebrow work.
Yeah,
you're so funny.
After watching,
yeah, I mean they the whole thing was like the whole film was made for like $10,000 maybe, and it was and it was all volunteer work. I love that idea. Like, I love the idea of a movie being made that was completely volunteer driven with no scripts, no actors, and then has these like amazing, like ingenious no budget special effects, especially near the end where it turns into this like psychedelic. You start like thinking you're tripping because it's so powerful at the end. So that's what the Arrival is. It was one student's vision into his past lifetime as this rogue space commander who'd turned into an aboriginal, but like the rogue space commander who'd blown up a planet with 6 billion people. Yeah.
Like a weird skunk robot army.
Yeah, like the skunks. The sideburns are so incredible in that film.
Oh, it was. It's definitely. I mean, even the beginning when the dude comes out of the spaceship.
Zan.
And the,
Zan's the
aboriginal dude. Yeah, when that guy, like all the special effects are really pretty incredible for 1979, right? Is that what it was? 79.
Yeah.
Like, and was that all? That was. They're from. What's the city in California? El Cajon.
And they filmed most of that between midnight and 6 a.m. in the morning. So imagine people with regular jobs, but they're young, so they can do it.
Yeah,
they can
get
no sleep, you know. That was the quietest time during the road because they were filming it right near the road, you know, in El Cajon.
Oh, wow.
And so all those, like, spaceship shots, you know, that required, like up to 60 times that film being rewound in the camera with really elaborate mats to create those special effects.
So they did that like with some kind of manual in camera. That's nuts.
It's hard for my brain to like even fit it in.
Yeah. Wow.
It's so good. And it was just somebody doing it because they loved it, you know. They were doing it as a creative collective.
And you came to The Arrival how did you hear about The Arrival? And
You know, I'd known about Unarius. I'd known about Unarius since the 90s. And
from, like, the research into Southern California
cults?
Actually,
from my ex-husband, who wrote about them in the 90s, and it's this book, Cult Rapture. And that was when I first heard about it. And then I visited them at the end of the 90s. And then I just curated a museum show recently. For the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore, Maryland. It's the first national museum dedicated to like visionary self-taught artistry.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, it's like my favorite museum in the country.
That's
like,
really cool.
Everybody who's listening, go to the American Visionary Art Museum. It will like change your life. You'll have new faith in art again. Huh. You know, after like contemporary art feels like such a dead zone, right. You know. So anyway, I was doing this show. It's called The Visionary Experience, and I wanted to put Unarius in it. So I went down to meet them, and I looked at all their art, and I didn't realize how much art they have there. It's not just the films, but they taught intuitive painting classes there. So it's not techniques. Like, they're not telling you how to create a nose or anything like that. But what they do is they teach you how to, like, go inward and commune with the Space Brothers.
Oh, wow.
And commune to your higher self and get their guidance to paint. So they have this, like, entire legion of outsider artists at Unarius who have painted incredible paintings of, like, other planets, Space Brothers, Uriel, stuff like that. So I befriended them. And when they told me about their, you know, their archive, their image archive as a documentarian, I was like, oh, my God.
Wow.
This could be so incredible. So we're actually working together right now, and I'm developing a documentary. I know, I'm so excited. I haven't told anybody that yet.
Is that breaking?
We got breaking.
Yeah.
We need scoop.
Beep, 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 beep. We need a breaking sound.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So that's the thing. I just started hanging out with them more. And that's my favorite thing, like with the Source family and Unarius and these other groups is – when you actually get to hang out with these people, you just realize it's a whole different deal than when you're an outsider just kind of looking at it with your own sense of irony or whatever you've got sort of clouding your vision.
So as a filmmaker, as a documentary filmmaker, I mean, I know I've never made a documentary film myself, but I do know that, like, there's, I think, a school of thought with documentarians of not getting to know their subjects too well.
Yeah.
And then there's obviously the people like you that get immersed in it.
Yeah.
So how do you see that?
The way that works for me, and I feel like it works really well, much better than just like the kind of filmmaker who comes in for like a year to try to learn something about someone and then tell these deep truths in their film. For me, I feel like it takes years, like, to really get to this super, I'm like a deep cuts kind of person, you know, like I want to know what nobody else knows. And I want to know it from the most personal level possible, because I feel like I just love original source material in the books I do and the films I do, and also I just have this personality, you know, my parents can tell you this about me, I'm the kind of person who, like, I just don't like to be told what to do, you know. So I'm not easily swayed by people. It's really easy for me to dip in deep somewhere and not lose it, because I've always got my own ideas, you know, about things, but I like to be very open. So for me, it's kind of a unique situation where I feel like I can be somewhat objective, but part of my role as a filmmaker is to be very subjective. And but I want to feel it. I want to feel it, like, deep inside as much as I can before I make my decisions about how I'm going to present it, you know. And I feel like doing that allows me to humanize my subjects more and give them the credit that they deserve and the honor that they deserve for taking big risks and operating way outside the box in order to find a meaningful existence for themselves. And I may not necessarily believe exactly what they believe, like, you know, but I sympathize with them and I can go there. Like, I can see it as being a plausible way to see the world. Like, their cosmology to me is as convincing as any other cosmology of any mainstream. All mainstream religions get crazy if you go deep enough. I mean, come on, the Old Testament, that thing is insane.
That shit crazy.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's good that you can, that you have that ability. I mean, I think that's what makes for a more relatable documentary too, in my mind, is like, if someone has that kind of passion and ability to do that. I think though, like, for me, for someone who's listening to this, I do feel like we need to, like, just to recap, which is The Source Family is a documentary about a family in LA in the late 60s, early 70s, right?
Yes.
The Arrival is a narrative film made by the
Unarius,
but not the student film.
No,
this was a $10,000 big budget.
Yep.
Quote. I'm making quotes again. I make a lot of air quotes on this.
It's also, they consider it a documentary.
They do. Yes,
that's what's so great. Oh, they consider it a documentary. Right. Oh yeah, because it's true. It's like I think the one of the first things says, you know, this was you know, this is a story that happened 100,000 years ago based on a true story.
Right, based on a true story. Yeah, I wrote that in my notes. Yeah. 160,000 BC,
right.
Based on a true story. Yeah. And then there's a guy who's nice white teeth. He's crawling through that. Like, I like that. That was one of my favorite parts. And then the whole Glinda thing with Archangel Ariel. I can't be the first one to think
that's
that.
So funny you say that, because I was trying to describe her to somebody the other day, and I was like, just imagine if Good Witch Glinda had a baby with Liberace on a spaceship.
Yeah, there's a lot of Liberace kind of vibe.
There is.
The Cadillac too.
Yes.
I was thinking about the Cadillac. Yes. That's a promo that was used from the. So what you did is you last year at CineFamily curated a showing which would include the arrival and I guess a lot of the cable access.
Yeah, I want to give some major props to CineFamily here, because I am a programmer officially, but I've always been a friend to them and such an admirer, because they take great risks down there. Mm-hmm. They do stuff before anybody else thinks it's amazing, and they show people why mm-hmm. it's amazing. They break a lot of ground and do a lot of great original programming. And so when I took this idea to the guys, Tom Fitzgerald, Hadrian Belove runs it. Tom Fitzgerald is one of the other main programmers. He was just like, oh my God, we've been wanting to do this for years. Like, you know the Unarians, let's do it. So we did. We had this huge art exhibit in the back with their original costumes and stills from their massive archive. And we showed a number of the cable access videos that they made, and then we showed the arrival in Underground Cities of Mars. And they had this, the Unarians were so awesome. We had them do workshops as well, like how to tap into your creative clairvoyance.
Wow.
And they drove the space cat up, parked it outside CineFamily, and they had doves released from the UFO one day.
What?
People were so into it. It was really
how many doves?
Ton of people came to the workshops too. A bunch of hipsters.
I can see that.
Like a dozen doves.
Oh, not 33. I thought maybe they would do like the 33 thing.
No.
They dig 33. Those guys dig 33.
A lot of people do. The Freemasons do too.
Oh, they do?
Oh, yeah. Magicians do. It's a very magical number.
It has the 3 in it.
Yeah.
Like De La Soul said.
Jesus died.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
3 is a magical number. Have you seen Children of the Stars? That
I have. Yeah, yeah.
That was out. That's
Yeah. I think that, you know, the Unarians, I talked to the Unarians about it. I was curious to hear what they thought about it. I commend anyone who tries to make a documentary film, because I know how hard it is. Like, documentarians, really, nobody knows. Like, we go to hell and back to make our films, and they're expensive. We hardly ever get our money back. So I really commend him for trying to make something, you know. It's really hard. The Unarius is such a complex subject, and it's so hard to go deep, to really go deep to the deep cuts.
Yeah.
So I think that like what he made is kind of a good start in a way. You know, the Unarians don't feel like it really reflects who they are that much. You know, like they and it's not that they wanted to be like more flattering or anything like that. The Unarians are not that way.
Right.
Like, they're really honest about themselves, and that's what I like about working with them. Like, and also they as a group, like, they don't deny the shadow. You know what I mean? They don't deny the dark stuff. You know, they just work through it. You know, they're not like one of those new age groups that's like, oh, everything's got to be positive and bright. But they, you know, I don't know. I can't get into it, but I'm going to make another one.
Good. Well, that's what I was. You'd be amazing.
Did have a question, which I guess you can't really necessarily answer this question, because I couldn't even find the actual text about it. But Ernest Norman wrote something about Chinese people being from Mars. I'm like, I gotta find the quote about that. Like,
Ask the Unarians about that.
Yeah, we have to ask them about that. Yeah, I know you can't speak on that behalf.
Wish I could. I didn't know about that.
That's
I love
a very
that.
Deep cut. Well, I was like, okay, well, this is gonna be interesting.
It is coming from George Chen.
Yeah,
too.
So,
like,
yeah,
he has an interesting
one.
Totally.
I'm just like, I want to know where my people are from. Maybe we're from Mars. Maybe
it's interesting, because a number of people have talked about life on Mars recently. So, like, the Unarians, like, they're cosmology seems so far out to some people, but really a lot of metaphysical groups have very similar principles about reincarnation and working with spirit guides. Native Americans have that, you know. And a number of people have talked about the underground cities of Mars, and who knows? Who the heck knows? I don't know.
I'm willing to believe. I went to a thing at the Exploratorium the other day, which just really breaks down like how many galaxies there are. Like, how many things we've seen in the sky that look like stars are just galaxies? Wow. And just statistically, the number of planets that are out there. There has to be something out there.
Well, there are more galaxies than sand on Earth.
And we're just,
what?
Boom.
Oh,
look what
my
I just
God.
Did.
You just blew my brain.
Uh-oh. I have to clean up this room after we're done.
Exactly. Going to wipe it down for the next interview. But no, there's definitely like the Hubble telescope's the thing that's gone the farthest out. And when you see it on a scale of like how far we've gone, it's like there's so much that we haven't really tapped, but they can identify a lot of it in this computer program where you can actually like see.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Oh, this guy, I forgot the name of the guy, but he just did this computer model display. Like, okay, so this is the edge of the universe that we know of. And there was a big bang here, so it's just, this is the outer edge. This
right.
Is nothing beyond that. I'm like, I can't visualize that. Oh, yeah, sorry.
Wow.
So maybe you don't know this yet, but what are you going to focus on in your documentary?
With the Unarians.
Yeah. Like, what's your, is it historical? Or is
I'm
it
still figuring it out. Part of me wants to tell the whole thing through their own films and just have, like, their voices going underneath
it. Well,
you
obviously have a talent for doing that with found footage.
I love working with the archives. Yeah, for people who haven't seen the Source family, most of that film is told through archival footage that the Source family members shot themselves in audio that they recorded themselves. And I feel like that is just, like, that's the gold. You know what I mean? It's the solid gold, especially for these two groups, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I did have, I mean, that's one thing I really appreciate about Source Family is how you show the present, I guess, 2010 or so, or
2012
or so.
Yeah.
Yeah, like where they're at now, and that you have that contrast of seeing them as 23-year-olds and at what they're at now. With the Unarians, so they had a date in 2001 that was supposed to be their apocalypse, right? Is that correct?
Well, not the apocalypse. See, that's the beauty of the Unarians. They believe that the future of planet Earth is positive and progressive. Mm-hmm. Okay. So they don't really. That's what I love about them. It's like, oh, thank
you. Yeah, it's not as dark as some of these other things.
Not at
it's
all.
Really
not at all.
Very.
No, they're a very gumdrop, like Candy Lane kind
of. Yeah. Well, you know, they just believe it's kind of like certain occult groups who believe that the universe is essentially harmonious and that the stuff that happens within it, the chaos, is kind of just like matter forming itself and shaping and rebuilding and renewing. So everything that happens is like you gathering wisdom. So all the bad things that happen to you are meant to teach you lessons so you can kind of evolve upward into this eternal spiral going up, not down, you know?
Right.
And so that gives you this structure from within which to have this cosmology that allows you to think that everything's going to be okay,
right.
Ultimately. And I love that because, you know, this is how I feel. Like, if you don't know, like, if you don't know if the world's going to end or if that the world's ending so a new, better world can begin, you might as well just believe in the better one. It's like, why go with
you
the other one if you don't know?
Yeah.
You know
you
what I mean?
You're given a choice.
Why feed into it? Because nobody knows.
Yeah.
Nobody.
They seem to be, like, one of the groups that is flexible about, like, well, Jesus was also a messenger, so like we can take the things that are already existing that other people believe.
Oh my God, yeah.
Integrate.
That's the beauty of reincarnation too. Like reincarnation allows you to experience history through a personal lens because you can be like, oh, I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you were, you know what I mean? Maybe you were there with Jesus or you know, maybe you were doing all of that. So with the arrival, like the prediction in 2001, she predicted it a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of a big deal at the time. You know, I mean, she announced this, like, Ladbroker's wager of $4,000. This was, like, back in 1974 the first time. And that was when she got all these TV interviews. She ended up on The Tomorrow Show with Tom Snyder. Late Night with David Letterman at one point.
I was trying to find the footage of that.
I know, I can't
anywhere.
Find it anywhere.
You
I've got
to go to that museum in New York or something. That has all the archives at the NBC archives.
That's where I'm going to probably end up going because I don't think the Unarians have it either. Mm-hmm. But when I asked the Unarians about that, I was like, how'd you feel, you know, when that happened? And she predicted and they were like, well, I was kind of disappointed. But then at the other end of things, you know, Uriel was saying, well, it was just a reliving. Like Uriel just admitted, well, I guess I was kind of off because I wasn't reliving another lifetime where I thought that this other thing was happening. I was like, it was when we, you know, Isis and Osiris, we were in Atlantis and we were doing this and everybody... you know, some people left Unarius. Like, some people were just like, oh, I can't handle this. She's not You know what I mean? She's not plugged in. Forget it. I'm going. But then there were other people who were just like, well, whatever. We love Uriel. I've learned so much. Like they had gained so much from being in the group. And she was such a loving person. That's what I love about Uriel too. Like she really wanted to help people consistently. She was all about giving to others, you know, and when you've got a charismatic leader who is truly an altruist and serves others and teaches them to think for themselves, like there's kind of almost nothing better. Like for me, if I could be hanging out with a superpowered clairvoyant who was really nice and wore rainbow capes, I mean, like, what's better than that?
Yeah. I just thought of something kind of interesting comparing the two things, because with Source Family, it is very much about this father figure thing, and with her, I know in the beginning it was her and Ernest, but it became after he passed, she's like a matriarchal figure, and it seems more like positive and like bright colors and everything in this different way. I mean, it's a different time period also, but yeah. Do you think there's something interesting about that, about having your leader be a female or a male?
I do. I think it's so fascinating to get to explore that role through the female's eyes and heart, you know. And also, she was in her 70s, so, you know, she wasn't, you know, she probably didn't have that same romantic drive.
I was going to say, you know.
But I will tell you that she had beautiful boys around her all the time.
There's that.
Straight and gay were in love with her. Yeah. And would do anything for her. And Kevin from Unarius told me that he went out to dinner with Uriel once, and she was surrounded with like six guys from, and there was this like 70-year-old woman next to her, and she was like, how do you do it?
I'll have what she's having.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
That's incredible. Oh, that picture with the Cadillac and that dude in the yellow jumpsuit. Oh. And I love that picture so much. I was like, I want her to be my grandma.
Yeah. Oh, totally. That's a classic photo by Douglas Curran, who wrote that. He made this incredible documentary that you guys might enjoy called In Advance of the Landing from like 1981. You can see it on YouTube. Which interviews, it's like a sympathetic documentary interviewing all of these UFO people who have like made folk art and are devoted to like UFOs and Space Brothers and Aliens Landing.
That reminds me, like, when did Whitley Strieber's book come out? Because then there's this sort of this dark turn that alien culture takes immediately about abduction and probing.
The cocaine years.
Yeah.
It's
very utopian UFO vision versus this very like Cold War paranoia UFO vision.
Yeah, it just all depends on who it filters through. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, he's a paranoid dude. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, everything's just one big messy, you know, glob, and then we decide whether it's like beautiful or ugly or
right.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Yeah.
So you never got to meet her.
No,
because she died
in
93.
She died in 93.
Right. Yeah. And then, so then 2001 comes, what she prophesized didn't happen. And then what I was reading is that this person who was writing this article that I read was, so they were surprised that people just didn't leave wholesale.
Yeah.
That people just stayed and kept the whole Unarian thing going.
That happens with a lot of millennial groups, you know, because there are so many throughout history. America's full of millennial groups, and that's the thing, you know. Leaders, for some reason, they just get these dates in their head, and because they have access to other unusual realms, truly they do. Yeah. I believe, you know, they start thinking that they might just be right on that. But if I could give advice to any future group leaders. Don't give dates.
Don't give dates.
Just don't give dates.
Yeah,
that's all.
Don't be specific about
Nostradamus.
Just
say in the very near future. That always gets people motivated.
My stepmom prophesied when I was a kid that the earth was going to end and Jesus was coming, and told us we didn't have to go to school or do our homework because Jesus was coming to take us away. It was like April. I remember I was like in fourth grade and I was telling all my friends like, peace out. Like, I don't have to go to school.
Oh my God.
The big Jesus is coming.
How long did you get to take off school?
Just a couple weeks.
Oh my God.
She left the group after that.
That's amazing.
No, it's just because it didn't happen.
What church was that?
Oh, we were a Pentecostal.
Oh, did you get the speaking in tongues then?
Oh, my
then?
God. And are you kidding?
You got it. See, that's my...
Oh, that's
putting
Jesus
your,
camp. Yeah,
put your hands up to God. And Pentecostal free denomination. So, Oh, yeah.
I love this. That's my favorite Christian denomination.
Oh, yeah. Because
that's the one that gets closest to, like, the sort of ecstatic, direct God experience. It kind of reminds me more of, like, shamanic ecstasy and voodoo. You know what I mean? That's the stuff.
It is, and it gets real weird.
Yeah.
Because there's the church that we went to for a while had these pods. So you had to be part. So then if you wanted to get a divorce or get a new car or paint your house a different color, you had to go to the elder of the pod to make sure that it was okay.
Whoa.
Yeah. And my dad was one of them. He was an elder of a pod.
Oh, my God. I'm going to talk to you more about this later.
It's crazy. Yeah.
I also like the idea that when you say millennials, it means something.
Right. I know. I thought the same thing.
Millennials. It's like, oh, you know, we're trying to appeal to millennials. I'm like, yeah, that's a good idea. Let's like oh my every God. Time, like, millennials are really into their phones. I'm like, are they? That's great.
I was going to ask you, does that mean people who believed after 2000 that something was going
to
happen?
Yeah. I guess that's one way to put millennial groups, like groups who near the end of different centuries that happened in the 1800s, you know, other groups. That happened. It's happened throughout time, and sometimes it's at the end of a century or the end of a millennium. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where there's like a time limit, and there's going to be a new era. So it's millennialists are sort of the flip side of the apocalyptic people.
What about Heaven's Gate? Did you ever get into those cats? Did you ever?
Nah, in the 90s I was into them. You know what I'm saying? Like to me, I've always been into those groups. Like I went through my Manson phase when I was a young child. Mm. but I felt like funny. All of like that perspective, you know, those groups were so picked over by transgressive subcultural thinkers, you know what I mean, and writers, and then people just kind of stuck on them. Like one of the reasons I put the Source Family together, I helped kind of ghostwrite that book, you know. I mean, it wasn't really me. I was just channeling Father Yod, you know, and helping Isis and electricity. But I just remembered thinking when I was doing that book, I was like, we're gonna knock Manson off his throne, man.
Nice.
Like the lame ass, boring evil cult leader. Will never be the same after this, you know?
Sure,
Because Yod had so much more to offer, and he really cared. Like, you know, for whatever you want to say about his flaws, there are so many people in the Source family to this day who were just like, he was the most amazing person I've ever met, and he loved us.
I found that very interesting, like how everyone had still was like, oh, there was an authentic instant charisma from this guy, and like the things that they couldn't explain.
He genuinely cared about people, and that's the one thing that really sets him apart from what we come to understand as cult leaders, you know?
Exactly.
When you wrote, did you use a script when shooting The Source Family?
No.
Interesting.
No.
So was it all edited? Was the story post, like in the editing room? Did you just kind of put it together?
Kind of. I mean, I knew the story because I'd already developed the material with the book, you know, so I'd really thought about it a lot beforehand. And then, you know, Maria came on board, and then Jen Harrington, who was really almost like a third a director, because she was able to help put together storylines for us so quickly. She's just so good at finding like the emotional, you know, crux of things. And so we went through all the footage, and then we created like a paper script of that afterwards, where we just did this like audio you know, bed, and then built from there.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
That is. And so when do you start shooting when you start putting your stuff for your new documentary?
Unarius?
Yeah.
We'll see. I'm writing a treatment for it right now, and I'm just doing a lot of research, because with the Source Family, I didn't do the film until like 3 or 4 years after I first really started diving into the material. With Unarius, I hope to get in quicker than that, because I want to start making it really soon.
Yeah.
But it's very important to me to really understand what I'm working with, and to understand like just the most valuable layers of it, you know, because that's where like the magic comes from, where you really get to blow people's minds. You know?
Is there a leader of Unarius now, or is it
no? That's what's
affiliation.
That's what's so different about the Source Family as well. Because with the Source Family, when Yod went off that cliff that day and passed on, it was kind of like cutting the head off from the body. Mm-hmm. The family none of them really liked each other. They were all there for Yod because they loved him so much, and he loved them. But there was a lot of infighting after the family. I mean, Makushla came and took over for a while, but she didn't really want to do that, and so it didn't last. But with Unarius, she had always prepared everyone to be a leader.
Oh wow.
You know, like she was like, A, you're psychic, you're gonna all become psychic, and B, you know, you're gonna do this in your life, you're gonna do that. Like, she really encouraged and nurtured and mentored people. So when she passed, Lewis Spiegel, took over, who was sort of her number one student for many years. But then he, after he passed, like just 4 years after she passed, it became this sort of collective. And so there are about maybe 10 Coriunarians that comprise this collective, and they make group decisions. And four of them are two couples who have been married for 25 years. And so they have a really nice kind of mellow, like they can be with each other. You know what I mean? Yeah. They're making their own decisions now.
So one of the last questions we asked the people we've interviewed is, what was one of your favorite documentaries? What's the documentary that got you into watching documentaries?
Oh, that got me into watching documentaries.
Or maybe something that influenced you and how you decided to approach your material.
I would say Grey Gardens.
Oh, yeah.
Grey Gardens, Frederick Wiseman, Titicut Follies, but also I really fell in love with the works of Les Blank. Les Blank is just one, I think he's just, his verite stuff and the heart, you know, and this like the soul that he captures in his subjects is so beautiful to me. And he always works with, you know, people who are sort of on the fringes, on the outside of traditional, you know, outside of mainstream society, but then they hold these traditions that are so valuable. I don't know if you guys, you probably haven't seen this yet, but do you know about A Poem is a Naked Person? It's the film he made on Leon Russell. It's just got restored. It premiered at South by Southwest. There are two major critics who have called it the greatest film ever made on rock and roll.
Oh, wow.
You got to see it. I love it. It's so good. That film blew my mind when I first saw it. And I ended up becoming friends with Les, which was like such a great thrill. So having him as a friend, you know, and mentor really influenced me a lot. But I like the verite guys who are really going at it in the 60s and 70s. That's kind of my favorite. I like it all. There's so much I like. I like that. And I also like stuff that's made by non-traditional filmmakers. So vernacular, like the Unaria stuff, like that's, to me, that's just like the pot of gold, you know, when I can never find any group, you know, even just like stuff of evangelical preacher, like, you know, like small time Pentecostal preachers on like West Virginia UHF, you know, channels. Like that's the kind of stuff I like, you know, stuff that's not made as something to be watched as a documentary, but it's documentary all the same, you know.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Jody.
Thank you both. I'm so happy to meet you both and do this. It's an honor to be here.
You can follow Jody on Twitter at Jody Willie.
And thank you very much to SF International Film Festival, Sean Yuyahara, and Morgan Davis for setting up our interview, letting us record at their space. It's a great festival. We got to see a lot of great stuff.
What'd you see?
We got to see the Wolf Pack, which we have to talk about at some point. I got to see the Residence documentary.
I saw Call Me Lucky.
Okay, yeah, I need to catch up on that one, too. There were so many good documentaries at that festival. Check out SFIFF. Thanks to them again. Hey, if you like the show, and we've got a couple out there now, hopefully you've been listening to all of them, please give us a good rating on iTunes and tell your friends about the show.
And the theme music was by David Siegel.
And you can check out our website, which is supdocpodcast.com.